You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós, Bolívar. That's 5 to 6 hours south from Cartagena in Colombia's Caribbean region. And I'm going to be the interviewee this week on this special episode again of the Columbia Calling podcast. One of your favorite guests, indeed reflected by the amount of comments I receive on any episode that she's been involved in. That's Emma Louise Jay. She'll be taking over the reins as the interviewer, and I'll be the interviewee for this episode. And we'll be talking about life under COVID here in Colombia and in Mompós. And it will be a good back and forth between two migrants to Colombia, talking about our realities here at this moment in time and our fears, I think, a little bit more. But I won't go too far into this because you'll have to listen to the show itself. Segment 3 will be hosted by Emma Louise Jay. Do check out her website. That's emmalouisej.com. She's on Twitter as well and on YouTube. You can see recent rants on there about what's going on in Colombia. So I'm going to leave you now in the capable hands of Emily Hart for giving us the newscast for this week, and then I'll be back as the interviewee. Thank you again for listening and stay tuned. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is news for Columbia Calling for the week of August 24th, 2020. Colombia was shaken by violence this week, with 5 massacres in the space of 7 days. 5 children were killed in Cali on August 11th. 8 young men were killed in Samaniego in Nariño 5 days later. On Friday, 5 people in Arauca and 6 in El Tambo, both in Cauca, were killed. 6 were killed on Saturday in Tumaco, and on Sunday night, the governor's office of Antioquia reported the death of 3 more young people in Venecia. 33 massacres were registered in Colombia in 2020, which will now be 38, including this week's. There were 36 in the whole of 2019, according to the UN. These recent massacres, though they took place up and down the country, were in rural areas formerly controlled by the FARC, places over which the government failed to assume control after the former guerrilla demobilization in 2017. The disarmament of the FARC created a new dynamic. In Colombia, there is no longer one major conflict, but numerous local ones, with varying armed actors, few of which act with ideological or ethical aims, more closely related to violent profiteering and domination of illegal industry, from cocaine to gold. The government have repeatedly promised to increase numbers of troops present in these areas, betting on a strategy that is more military than structural. The killings of social leaders also continue in the countryside. At least 1,000 of Colombia's human rights defenders and community leaders have now been assassinated since the beginning of a peace process that began in late 16, according to group Indepaz. Over 50% of the victims had taken part in the peace process directly. The 1,000th assassinated leader was Fabio Andres Gomez, a farming community leader from Argelia, a town in southwest Cauca. 36 of the assassinated victims were leaders in indigenous communities. A further 10 were leaders in Afro-Colombian communities. Former President Álvaro Uribe is facing charges of witness tampering and bribery. He is under house arrest. This week, Uribe resigned from his Senate post in a bid to argue that the Supreme Court is no longer the appropriate body to conduct his trial, it being the court which deals with the trials of public functionaries. Now that he no longer holds a seat in the Senate, it is argued that the public prosecution is the appropriate court for his investigation, a notoriously corrupt institution with close ties to the ruling party, Centro Democrático, of which Uribe is founder and leader. Colombia has now passed 17,000 COVID-19 deaths, with recorded cases at over 540,000. Pressure is, however, easing on intensive care units, with capacities back at over 80% in many cities. Bogotá's mayor, Claudia López, will seek to end lockdown measures in the coming week. That was the news bulletin. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
La canoa de Bareque, para llegar a la playa. And this is the final segment of episode 339 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And as I mentioned in segment one of the show, I'm taking the back seat in this show. And Emma Louise Jay, who you'll know from, well, I think the person who's been most on Columbia Calling as a guest. And indeed, she's interviewed me in the past. And that's what she's going to do today. She's going to be interviewing me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Montpos. Emma Louise Jay, you'll remember, is the Downton Abbey with a machete episode, and of course conquered by Columbia before that. And you can see all of her writing, very, let's say, perceptive and intuitive writing at emmalouisej.com. So I'm going to stop talking as a host and get back into my chair as the interviewee and hand you over now to Emma in Antioquia.
Well, hello, Richard. Thank you very much for allowing me to interrogate you today about your lockdown experiences in Montpos. I think for lots of us, you know, we follow you and we're obviously every day you're trying to tell us exactly what you're seeing and what's going on in Montpos. So perhaps we can explore that a bit more. So why don't you tell us why you decided to leave Bogota, your normal base, and spend the remainder of your lockdown in your sort of second, shall we say, second home, I suppose, in Montpos. What informed that decision?
You know, it's curious, and I think some people may have read it on social media and so on. I took a long time, in fact, we took a long time as a family deciding this. I guess one element was in the back of my mind is hopefully this will come to an end soon. Of course, that seems so naive right now and, you know, bright-eyed. Because the whole idea of coming to Montpos is to come here more as business owners and for a break from Bogota rather than from an escape from Bogota. We have our businesses here and lots of, you know, extended family and friends and so on. But more importantly, space. And those of you who follow this and listen to this podcast know I have a 5-year-old son and a 7-month-old son. And, you know, James, my 5-year-old, he didn't know it, but we could see it. He was definitely suffering after 105 days of lockdown in Bogota. You know, we could go out into the car park and he could scoot around on his scooter and maybe see a couple of little friends, neighborhood friends from a distance, maybe throw a ball and so on. But that's no... You know,
that's
this is no
so
activity
tough
for a child of 5. And you know what happens? I know it happens a lot, but it becomes completely absorbed by, you know, touch screen phones and iPads and the computer. And he starts ignoring, you know, like the train set and the car set. And so it takes more time as a parent. You know, he's still 5. He's not quite capable of playing alone. And so, you know, I have to get down the floor and play and stuff. And this is fine up to a point, but I can't do it all the time. And we figured, well, you know, we go to Montpos, we'll have more space and we've got a swimming pool. And lockdown is supposed to be pretty strict here. And we do have absolute total curfews on Saturdays and Sundays, although it doesn't seem to be respected. But we can go on, you know, our bicycles between our house and the Casa Maria and the San Rafael hotels, you know, without stopping, without talking to anyone. And this variety and just a slightly more outdoors lifestyle has been a benefit. But of course, there are other things to weigh up. Internet connection is patchy, so not so easy for his virtual classroom or our work. And if it gets really, really, really bad, I mean, worse than it is now, which it looks like it's going... what is the food security going to be like? And that's those are things.
I think I probably understand what you mean, but for, I don't know, people listening that maybe they're in a slightly different part of the country, what do you mean by food security?
Well, we're stocked by, you know, let's say local providers, but local providers are small providers. So if there are a huge increase in cases in these small providers and small farms around here, are they going to be able to get their produce to our markets? And also the only sort of big provider we have is Olympica. Now, Olympica will always get here. You know, it's obviously owned by the Char family in Barranquilla, you know, presidential hopeful, et cetera, et cetera. But if it gets really, I don't want to get into that quite yet, but if it gets really, really bad, Will there start being, you know, being greater limitations on movement? I'm very concerned at the moment. This last weekend was a long weekend, not that it really mattered, but I saw a lot of people from the neighboring town. So the neighboring town, about 45 minutes away on the other side of the river, which we now have a bridge built to. There's a lot of fanfare over this bridge built between Magangue and Montbos. It's like 12 and a half kilometers of bridge. People have been crying out for it since time immemorial. And now we have it. And I saw these people coming over just for day trips on their motorcycles, maskless, of course, and coming over and checking out. And you can tell who they are because they're not, you know, first of all, they're all staring at me and, you know, because I'm the gringo, because they're not used to seeing gringos in Magangue. But, you know, to everyone here, I'm known. And so you can start seeing who's this. And we stopped a couple and said, well, you know, what are you doing? And so, oh, we're just spending the day. We're from Magangue. Now, Magangue has more than 1,000 cases and, you know, double figures in deaths. And yet they've decided, because they were bored, they came over and there were a bunch. And so you sort of think, you know, the freedom of movement between these two towns probably needs to be limited somewhat. But, you know, herein lies the problem.
This is, I think, a very important issue, this issue that you're bringing up of the freedom of movement. I wondered if you could tell us, how was your journey, for example, from Bogota to Montpos? I know that's now probably, what, a couple of months ago, was it, that you made the journey? What was the journey like? You know, how were the roads? Were there army? You know, describe to us what the journey was like for you.
Well, we as we always do, we left in the dark hours of the dawn, but to get out of Bogota before any traffic. Even
always like that.
It's always like that, whatever. You know, I think we left around 3:30 in the morning, because if you do that, you can get here in 12 hours, because we weren't going to be able to stop anywhere. We had called hotels in Barranca Bermeja, where my wife is from, and they said, yeah, you know, you can only come into Barranca Bermeja if you've got the paperwork showing that you are negative for COVID-19.
Wow.
And there were lines as we passed the entrance areas, you know, the turnoffs for Barranca Bermeja, there were lines of cars, and you could see at the front, you know, the sort of military checkpoint with medical, you know, sort of contagion suits and so on, looking at each
car.
Yeah. And this all the way through from Santander to Cesar, most of the towns were in this. And of course, we called the hotels and they said it can only be two people to a room as well. And I said, well, we're two adults and two minors. And they were like, yeah, but the minors, it would have to be one of you with one child and one of you with another child. And it's just like, this seems like a lot of work.
Yes, especially if you're already a household.
Yeah, exactly. So we said, we're going to do it in one. I mean, you know, I've done it several times this way in 12 straight hours, and it's tough work and not a lot of traffic. But you again, where the traffic builds up is the turnoffs to local towns and local areas where they have these, again, restrictions on entry. Lots of army. In fact, we didn't get stopped once. We were incredibly lucky that every time we went past the checkpoint, they were busy. And I passed 5 checkpoints. And you know, at these checkpoints, if they decide that whoever's in charge, that you don't have what they feel is the appropriate documentation, then you're going to be hit up for a bribe. And we had everything. We had absolutely everything. And I have my, you know, fire extinguisher up to date and everything. You know, I even have the pair of gloves that you're meant to have in the repair kit, because I'm a gringo and I know I get pulled over. I've got it
exactly.
All. And they get, it's happened before that they were infuriated that I had everything in order. You know,
yes, how can you possibly have the right fire extinguisher?
So we got through, you know, the only time we got stopped was an informal checkpoint. Here, crossing between, well, getting from the Department of Magdalena into Bolivar at a town called Guamal. Mm-hmm. And it was an informal one where the people are very, it's a humble, humble town. A lot of sort of bareke, mud and straw homes. And definitely suffering from a lack of food and a lack of income and everything else. And they just said, you know, can you give something? So we gave, you know, some pesos and some food, and they dropped the barrier and let us go. And that was it. But the roads are still chock-a-block with trucks. That's still going on. Yes. And now, you know, the trucks are always the kings of the road here. We very nearly got ran off the road at one point because they're now, because there's so little like actual automobile traffic, they're not looking. They're looking even less into their side mirrors. And we've got very, very, we were very close. Driving in Colombia is not fun. let's not go to
no.
And long distances.
Well, it can be, but you'd really you have to be in the right mood for it, yes. Don't you? Really, and when you were sort of escaping Bogota, that's not really.
It was an escape from Bogota. We made it. We're here, and we're definitely better for it. But of course, we're in a different situation now.
Yeah, describe for us. I mean, I've never been to Mompos, as you know, but describe for us what Mompos feels like right now. I mean, how empty are the streets? What is the temperature like? You know, give us a taste of how Mompos is at the moment.
Well, you caught us on a good day because we woke up with rain and it started raining at 5 a.m. and it rained almost until midday. And so temperatures are in the upper 20s. I'd say around 27 today, which is about the coolest you'll ever get it in Mompos. put it this, you know, when I record, I have to turn off the fans because of the noise that they, you know, the ambient noise. And so I'm always, you know, a lot of the time I'm just sitting here in shorts recording because it's too hot. Today I'm in a shirt and shorts and the fans are off and I'm okay. But normally I'm just dripping. A few days ago, it was very easily 36, 37 degrees and the humidity up at 100%. And we're under lockdown, but there was no reason for me to leave the house, you know, nothing at all. I said, yeah, I'm not going anywhere. And then the pool
that
we have.
That's actually a really interesting point that maybe do you think the climate keeps people inside more?
You know, here the practice is business is done early in the morning or in the afternoon. Anyway, you're a fool to be out in the heat of the sun. Uh-huh. So if you're making a house call, it's usually in the later afternoon. And if you're doing your banking or anything else that you need to do, it's usually, you know, quite early on. People here get up early. It's a farming community. So they're up early. They're already out and about. By midday, most businesses now are shut. And they don't open again. That's part of the requirements. So you can find a couple of places, a couple of pharmacies and so on. But I mean, it's absolutely silent right now. I mean, we're recording at 3:30 in the afternoon.
I know, I couldn't hear anything.
It's absolutely silent. People are afraid because in the last few days, from one day to the next, we had a spike in more than 70 cases.
Oh, my goodness me.
And I think it was more of a backlog of cases. But we had a spike in more than 70 cases from one day to the next. And people are very, very afraid. You know, we all now know of people who have had it or who are, you know, suffering or who have, you know, tragically died from it. So, but we're in this, you know, it's a situation here. I mean, this beautiful, beautiful town. You asked me what it's like. It's like what I imagine, you know, in a picture book, because we're not like harangued by hordes of people going about their day-to-day business. It's now a very, very sleepy, beautiful colonial town. But there is this element of apprehension and you can feel it. And of course, small town gossip, where previously, you know, the worst thing that you would say in a small town about someone else is, oh, we think that guy's homosexual. You know, that's it's small town chat. Now it's we think they've got the virus. You know, that's,
oh, really? Yeah. Like kind of speculating about who might be infected,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Precisely. You see someone with all their doors and windows shut. It's like, well, they must be self-isolating because they've got the virus. You know, it's a lot of gossip and you know, I wrote on my blog, of course, that I've had the virus. It's now been, you know, proven that I had the virus way back in February. And I told I told the local priest, who's a neighbor, and he couldn't believe it that I would say. Mm. He's like, people keep it quiet.
This is an interesting issue because, you've mentioned this on Twitter, but as you say, you've written extensively about it on your blog, and I think nobody else has really talked about this, which is the stigma aspect to the virus. You know, do you think that you speaking out and saying that you realized that you had been infected? I mean, you were ill at the time, weren't you, in February, I think, but you didn't actually realize what you were ill with at that time, and now you realize what it probably was. Could you tell us a bit more what you think about this issue of stigma and the virus in Colombia?
Well, you know, stigma here in Colombia comes from everything. You know, the stigma of being left wing, therefore you're tired as a guerrilla sympathizer. Then I suppose if you're, you know, right of center, we would then, you know, tie you with the fact of being a Uribista. You know, I don't know. Let's get those both out of the way. But the stigma here runs very strong. This, you know, rural Colombia and of course parts of urban Colombia, but it's a very mystical place. Here we have religious syncretism, very much so in Mompox, where churches are built on top of, you know, pre-Columbian burial sites, the Spanish colonial churches. This is what they did to, you know, to help convert. It was a way of converting the local indigenous people because it was already a sacred place.
Wow.
And you start seeing the different symbolism in churches, and you start seeing, and of course, you know, even when I come to my own extended family here, they will, you know, get a house blessed by the priest in the morning and then blessed by the shaman in the afternoon. That it's very much of the Pachamama as well as the Catholic Church here. That both are very much played off. So the stigma around all of these things comes into it. And when you have this feeling where it's now, I think, out of the hands of the church or an organized religion, they feel that they must turn again back to a more earthy, response, which on many levels is perhaps more holistic, perhaps more pleasant. But at the same time, when it's out of hand, then the people themselves behave in an out of hand matter. And let me explain myself. Is that the stigma comes. I don't want to share any more that I had it, because the first reaction here is, oh, well, you're the foreigner. You got the foreigner's disease. So let's start with that. And then those people in the town, in outlying areas who have had it, or in barrios over the other side of the highway and so on, there have been the threats of trying to burn down their houses and scare them out of town. Yes, the police had to come and make a ring around a house. And, you know, when I said to someone...
That's just horrendous.
When we arrived, there were only, three or four cases, right? There's now 145, 146. So that's a month and a half. I said, well, yeah, there are three cases. And someone said to me, yeah, but two of them aren't from Mompox. I was like, what do you mean two of them aren't from Mompox? Well, they came in from the town of Botón de Leyva, which is it's what you call a hamlet, you know, sort of 35 minutes away. Well, of course they came to Mompox because this is where there's healthcare. I mean, per se, there's healthcare. I said, yeah, but they're not from here. So it's, again, almost like another foreign disease, because it's not Mompox. Because Mompox is clean. It's a foreigner. It's not foreign, you know, internationally, but it's also foreign within a domestic circumstance. So you get all of this weird stigma coming around. It's someone else. It's someone else. It's the other. So I don't know where I stand on I've told people, and I'm therefore the gossip mill in Mompox must have gone at a billion miles an hour, because you can spread something in seconds here. All I had to do is
they probably have WhatsApp groups just about you or something.
There's a WhatsApp. Yeah, I'm sure there is. He's coming. You know, hide. But, you know, it's one of these things. And of course, now I'm hearing their latest one is the reason for the large uptick in contagions here in Mompox is that the Secretary for Health in Mompox held a party and invited people from Magangue. I just think it's a lie. It just seems too. It could be true. Who knows? It's like. it's such a small town.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, you know, like you, I'm currently living in a small village as well. And I have found, like, being an immigrant at the moment, and immigrant stroke foreigner, it's kind of there's on the one hand, if I walk around the village once a week, I feel like people look at me more like, oh, she might be infected, like, oh, foreigner. Like, I've even seen people cross the street, you know, or something, like when I walk along. But on the other hand, the fact that I've stayed in the country during the lockdown, I think, and a lot of foreigners, you know, all the other foreigners left, basically, it's sort of people start to see you more as part of the community. So it's this weird mixture of you're now even more part of the community, but because you're foreign, you're a more dangerous presence than a local. Do you relate to that? Do you feel that at all?
I think that, you know, that might have been it a little bit as well. Again, here I'm known. It's been how many years it is now, 12, 13 years of having the business and so on, and you're known. But again, when I think of all the people from Magangay coming over, and not just staring at the gringo, but staring at the other, and I think that I may have represented a threat in their minds, you know. But they're the ones who are coming from the major hotbed in this region. So, you know, how do you weigh this up? I don't know. It's but the stigma, again, I haven't had my house stoned as others have. Others have had their houses, rocks thrown at their house and so on. You know, one thing,
biblical.
That's it, isn't it? I want to relate to an event that happened here pre-COVID many years ago, is that some people were unhappy with the way the politics was going, and the mayor at that time, much like many of the mayors of Mompos, was doing nothing. And so they took the town hall hostage. They took it and they burnt all the old files in there,
like a kind of junta with a match, I guess.
Yeah, it was it, and they burnt it all down. And what was my reaction? Oh, great, well, I've got rid of my, you know, my court summons. You know, that was my reaction. So you start getting into this town, you know, thought process.
Yes, it's I was going to ask, actually, but you kind of touched on it. Perhaps you can say more about it. Like, Mompos is obviously famous, isn't it, for its what do you say, Holy Week in Easter, Semana Santa. Do you say Holy Week in English?
Yeah,
for
your Holy Week.
For Semana Santa, yeah. Which of course was not possible this year because of the what is the situation as regards religion in Mompos at the moment? Are churches open? Do you think that the community kind of miss church, because in these small villages sometimes, like, church is the main activity, at least where I am. What's the situation in Mompos with that?
Interesting, because we have seven churches, I want to say, off the top of my head.
Wow.
yeah, but they're from the Reconquista. It's not from the beginning of Mompos, and let's go back. But Mompos is a port, and so therefore it had every manner of all the vice that came in with a port: the prostitution, the gambling, the drinking dens, the slavery. That's what it was. And then when the Inquisition arrives and comes, we can't have this. And so that's the second wave of settlement in Mompos, or third wave, better said. And so the Inquisition comes in, and with the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Jesuits, and then they all put up their churches. And so therefore, again, to make it a religious destination, but it's all a bit of a faux pas. Religion obviously plays a very major part in village life and in the people's lives. But as I said, they mix it. They mix both of it with the Pachamama, the Mother Earth, and more indigenous, let's say, or Aboriginal beliefs. But the act of going to mass is very much a community thing. Now, there are no services. They are broadcast live on Facebook Live. One of our local, let's say, town reporters broadcasts them on Facebook Live. And on this note, and so I know a lot of the sort of older generations in Mompos are suffering immensely, because this was their activity, you know, the social activity. I had my son's baptism, I guess it was just over a week ago now, and one of his godparents, who's my stepbrother in the UK, in Frimley, in I think that's Surrey, he was able to attend via WhatsApp. So I propped up my phone on the altar, pointed at the, I guess, the baptism, you know, water, the holy water, where the, and he was there and was addressed by the priest that way. So there you go. You know, we're getting around it, but it's not the same. It's not the same for these people, the regular churchgoers. Again, this is their social and community activity. Yeah. We didn't have, there aren't enough churchgoers to have mass in every single church every day. Mm-hmm. So they do rotate them between different the dioceses of which ones which. Now, Semana Santa, of course, Easter week is always our, one of our big events here, and the very famous and austere processions that start at 5 p.m. and go on till 5 a.m. And the Nazarenes are local people, humble people. It's not the wealthy people like in Popayan. These are the humble people from the towns, and it's a real honor. And they'll do the 3 paces forward, 2 paces back for the for most of the 12 hours in this heat under heavy tunics. It is a sight to behold. I don't leave the house. It's even hotter than that time because you get the heat from the people as well. But it is amazing. And, you know, I think that most Colombians wish to come. But again, it's this thing of Catholicism. You only see the priest on Palm Sunday and then on Good Friday, because the rest of it is Masonic and it's held by masters of ceremonies. So while you know our tourism entities will obviously tag Mompos as religious tourism, and it is, there are other stories behind this which for me make it far more interesting. You know, not rather than just being a devout town, there's a far more interesting or more curious history behind it.
With the other aspect, I think, with that you're talking about with religion, is that it can sometimes be, I have to be careful how I put this, linked in with education. And that, for example, here I've noticed that particularly at the beginning, people thought, well, you know, if you got the virus, basically, you know, God wanted you to get ill, you know, kind of like it was God's will, basically, whether you got ill or not. What do you think? People, you know, is that something that you experience in Mompos? Do people think, you know, is there a relationship between people's religious beliefs and how seriously they take protecting themselves against contagion?
Yeah, absolutely. My wife and I are godparents to a little boy here in Mompos whose grandparents picked us out. They are rubbish collectors in the streets, and we've always treated them well. And they asked, you know, very humbling for me and very touching. They asked us to become the godparents to their grandson, which was many years ago now. And we did so. And I ran into them the other day in the streets, and they're doing it, and they're doing their recollection of basuras, picking up the rubbish, you know, freelance rubbish collectors. Very humble people. And they said, well, you know, Mompos is a religious place. Mompos is good with God. We're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. And, there's nothing I'm going to say to that. It's just the truth. For them, it's the truth. You know, I'm not going to lay in from my sort of post-religious European background and say, I just nod and I say, you know, we just have to look out for one another. And that keeps them happy, and you know, I've not disrespected anyone, but there's definitely that level of, you know, the God fearing person will be the one who is saved or spared.
I see.
And they do, you know, you do see on the Mompos forums and Facebook, you know, Gran Misericordia de Dios, and blah blah blah, all of these things. And I'm just like, have you been to downtown Bogota? I mean, have you seen how the people are suffering in the comunas? You know, and these are religious people too, you know, but I shouldn't get into this. It's not for me to do this.
Yes.
If this makes them feel more as a community and more, you know, safer, I suppose, then you know, it's fine. I mean, you know, where I stand on religion does not come into this.
That's the thing, isn't it? Everybody's finding comfort in different ways. One of the people that groups of people that I feel are particularly vulnerable at the moment are children. and you're a parent, you know, I'm not a parent, but you're a parent of two boys, as you mentioned before. How do you think your children are making sense of and coping with lockdown? How are they being affected by the pandemic?
Well, I mean, James, the five-year-old, he's the one who struggles, of course. He wants to be with his little friends and running off the steam. And he wants to be in his classroom. You know, were he in his classroom, he'd say he wouldn't want to be. But that's just a five-year-old. I sometimes feel like I've got a teenager in the house. Like, that's to come.
Yeah.
He wants to be with it because the happiness at seeing his friends, you know, albeit on a screen, I can see it. You know, it beams out of him, and there's a couple of neighbors who are in his class and stuff. You know, it's hard for him. You know, he does say, "Oh yeah, I guess we can't do that because of the coronavirus," and it breaks my heart.
Oh,
you know, at a 5-year old.
Do you think he understands like what that? I mean, because I'm not a parent, I'm a bit out of touch with young children. Like, do you think he understands what is going on? You know, with sickness and well.
I don't think he fully understands. I think he knows that there's, you know, restrictions on life.
Right.
But I think, I mean, like all, it's like, it'll, you know, he believes it will go back to normal and it will be like after, of course it's not going to, you know, when they do get back to school. And if I say this, I probably jinx it, but it supposedly towards the end of September, the schools will open, the private ones like where he is studying, for 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So one half of the class will go for 2 weeks and then take 2 weeks off. And then the other half of the class will go for 2 weeks. So they'll be doing it that way. But, you know, Francis was born on the 2nd of January. So he was born just before.
It's a lockdown baby, basically.
He's a lockdown baby. He knows nothing else. But when we left Bogota in the car, he'd never done anything like that. I mean, his life had been journeys to the clinic and back. That was it. You know, we took him to see his pediatrician. That was it. So, I mean, the information overload of being in a car and being able to see out the window and seeing other people. And when he arrived in Mompos, obviously, you know, the grandparents were out waiting for him. But he didn't remember them. You know, he was only weeks old when they were there. And all of the Costeño family came over to try and, you know, to cuddle the newborn, as is their wont. Because,
of course, it's just normal, terrified. Isn't it, that you cuddle baby?
He was terrified. Well, and of course, Costeños, I mean, well, in my experience, and quite an extensive experience, quite loud. Quite shouty, even though when they're talking, and quite ebullient, and he's not used to that. He's a very much a cachaco, and used to the quiet, and used to not too many people being around him, and suddenly you know he's exposed to this. Yeah, I mean, he had a meltdown that first day because he couldn't get his head around it, and even the other day when his uncle showed up. For the first time, and it came up with his Costeño bravado, even though he's Santanderiano, but with Costeño roots, you know, it came up, and Francis couldn't take it. He said, "Who is this loud person?" And during the baptism as well, James asked the priest to stop shouting because his little brother didn't like it.
Well, I'm marking out James for a big future. I think I think this guy's a leader. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll tell him you said that.
Yeah, you spoke a bit a minute ago. You touched on it, like this feeling that things may not go back to normal, that, you know, we don't really know what normal is, you know. So let's, I don't know, it's obviously a bit sensitive, but let's move towards politics a bit. you know, what's your... You know, you're always very diplomatic, you know, you're extremely diplomatic and you have a very good way of talking about these matters. What's your view on the political atmosphere at the moment in Colombia? Should we put it like that? Political atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, Colombia's polarized. Everywhere's polarized. Perhaps this isn't the most that Colombia's ever been polarized. I mean, we've lived through we haven't, but the country's lived through the National Front. It's a tough time here. We have a president in charge who at best would have, and I've said this in previous, I was interviewed about this some time ago, but at best, I'd say, would have maxed out his political career at vice president or cabinet member. He's not a leader. He's not someone who stands up and instills confidence and can lead a nation. And if he, you know, he didn't have an easy task ahead of him anyway. Let's say, put it there. And I'm trying to, I'm tiptoeing around a few things.
Yes.
But as you know.
No, but I know what you mean.
He
didn't have a good, he didn't have an easy job on his hands, let's put it that way.
Colombia is not going to be an easy place, but he's a hapless person, made even more hapless in an absolutely undesirable situation for anyone. You know, I do not blame him for the virus.
I certainly don't either. No.
But he's not the person. And I don't have a person's name. I don't have someone who I'd say this person could have done it. And I'm, God forbid, you know, Gustavo Petro were in charge. We can but speculate. That's the truth. But to have this guy in charge is not something where I thought, wherever you stand on Churchill for something or other, you know, for however many years, people stood behind his speeches and his know-how in addressing a nation. I can't turn on the evening Duque address.
No.
That, let's put it into that context. And I know there's vast differences between the two men, but there's all sorts of arguments, criminals, war criminals, blah, 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 this, that. But do you want to listen to a Churchillian speech or do you want to listen to a Duque speech?
I'm at the same stage as you. I can barely watch the day. I think it's daily, isn't it? Political. Yeah. Well, he calls it an address, but it's a propaganda sort of bulletin. Yeah. I would say. I mean, I don't feel it's very much in touch with the level of suffering that people are going. I mean, you know, if I go to El Retiro now, almost all of the businesses that were small businesses, restaurants, you know, this kind of thing, they've all gone. I think there were a few hotels, you know, very small sort of hostel style hotels. Of course, none of them have any clientele. They're in the same situation that you're in. I mean, how are you now feeling, you know, because I think you said earlier, we spoke 3 months ago. How are you now feeling about it? It's now been basically 6 months of lockdown now, which is a long time. What's your view on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you put up a YouTube address.
A rant.
And you verbalized very well this, you know, we were all, who of us was, in opposition to a lockdown at the beginning.
I wasn't
at all. I was totally, you know, on board, again, from the strength of my bank account at that moment and, of course, upper middle class, you know, living conditions and the possibilities of this moving on faster and not having to, you know, yomp it out to make ends meet. But we're now into 6 months and I have no significant bank account and maybe one or two guests a week. I would say, you know, medics or business owners coming in. This does not go anywhere near enough to pay my staff, whom I have kept on because for those of you who know small towns in Colombia's Caribbean region, the people here are not well off. In most of my staff, a lot of them are single mothers and, you know, live in what we would say sort of ranchitos or cambuches of dirt floors. Do not, very precarious conditions, no running water, very little else, in truth, and what they earn and what we pay into their healthcare is what they have. Someone said to me, you shouldn't feel sort of afflicted by the, you know, responsibilities. I am responsible for these guys. They've looked after me, you know, in periods when we've been overrun with people. And I've needed them to work extra hours and extra days, all fully compensated, of course. But now they're looking to me in return. But it's 6 months now. And
it's really, really tricky. I think there's two issues that you touch on there that I was going to ask you to expand upon. One is about the issue of money and banking and how easy it is perhaps as a foreigner here to do any international banking. And the second issue is you've coined this term, at least I believe you've coined it. I haven't seen anyone else using it, but you've coined it on Twitter before. The veil is slipping. This beautiful phrase, quite poetic, that you've coined. Tell me what you mean by that. In what way do you think that certain issues that you're touching on there have become more, perhaps more exaggerated or more apparent?
Well, I think it's that, you said this as well on your YouTube, is that we don't get bored. I read, I write, I have children, I have businesses to try and rescue. I don't get bored.
Yeah.
But I do despair. And when I talk about the veil is slipping or the veil is being lifted, and I have used it, it's the incoherences, injustices and inequalities that have been forever present in Colombia are that much more visible. Those of us who live here and have been trying to improve things, albeit in our tiny, tiny, little spheres, but doing so.
Trying our best
are now, there's just no way around it. Before we'd say, well, look, I've created something that's making an economic stimulus that is helping. I've seen change. One of the ladies who works, her daughter is now, her daughter is actually studying to be a nurse. Her mother can't read nor write, single mother. She has studied. She's gone off to Barranquilla. The money goes off to this girl to study to be a nurse. This is social change. And this is how, I was able to sort of weigh off certain things. Even things like banking, I would weigh it off, say, but we are, maybe I'm just, again, naive, pinko, lily-livered, liberal, and trying to do my own thing. But it worked, it worked through this. Because it's, again, it's about the economics of these things. And now we see so much of the reality because the COVID-19 has lifted the veil because the inequalities are even more present. Look at these poor people who cannot make a living selling, headphones or fruit from a stall in the street anymore. The kid round the corner who used to look after, let's say, as like a car park attendant for motorcycles, gaining, 200 pesos for each motorcycle. But out there, all day long in the blazing hot sunshine, he's not earning.
Exactly. I think, I don't know about where you are. Here there have been some, what do you say, is it subsidies? Where they would give out, a bag of rice and things like every couple of weeks. Have you seen any evidence of that?
I addressed this with the musician Gregorio Uribe some weeks back on this show, is that we both know a musician here and his band. In fact, the musician played at my wedding all those years ago, and he is a very humble man, and his whole family are the musicians, and they're sort of carpenters and so on, but there's no work. But so I found the most dignified way of being able to give him money, because I know he's desperate, is to take drumming lessons. And so I've been paying him for drumming lessons, and he does get subsidies, and it's a family of about eight. They get 160,000 pesos a month. So that's what,
I just it's very, very, difficult to survive on that. I mean, I just can't imagine how anybody would survive on that, honestly.
And he comes round and I say, Samuel, you want a juice? He goes, yeah, I've stopped drinking juice because I can't. Wow. It's a luxury. That's in a country where the mango trees are rarely empty, and everyone gives away mangoes because there's too many of them, or there's too many papayas, or there's too many something else. People are no longer doing that.
I've noticed here people eating from trees, for example. I mean, I know, probably that happened before, but now I see people actually living off that. I mean, it's such a difficult time. Emotionally, what do you feel has kept you sane and what has been knocking you off kilter at times, if at all.
I think, yeah, we could go for hours. We might have to start winding down, but I'll address this one. I don't know if I've been kept sane. Let's start that way. I don't know if I went into this sane.
This is my last question anyway, okay. so you can say whatever you want.
I don't know if I went into the sane. I think I've always been a little bit, I mean, even my godmother in England refers to me as the eccentric one. So, I mean, you know, kept me sane is that my life really, in terms of my sort of intellectual and life, has not changed. Uh-huh. I'm still reading and writing. And I'm still trying to sell articles, albeit less as a journalist. And I still really want to be here with my children. And that is one thing. But it's just watching my income and my savings dwindling to nothing is really fraying my nerves, and it keeps me awake at night because I'm thinking, you know, how do we continue?
Uh-huh.
How? And it's not just, okay, well, you know, we'll find a way somehow. I'll sell something, be it a kidney, or my car or whatever. We'll find a way of raising some money. There's always a way. In my circumstances, you know, upper middle class. This is not, you know, I'm not in a, but at the same time, it keeps me awake at night thinking that I have so many rooms empty. And also, you know, I know we shouldn't reflect on what could have been, but this year, when I looked at, you know, you always take a look at what the year looks like with reservations. Yeah. I mean, this month, August and July, we didn't have a bed free.
Sad.
And so you're looking at these, we've gone for the hundreds of thousands of dollars lost now. And and most of these reservations have been actually moved till next year by the agencies who did them. But whether, you know, the agencies are also obliged to give the money back if the people say in a year's time that they don't want to come to Colombia. Who knows in August 2021 where we were going to be?
I think that's the point, isn't it? Like, at the moment, we don't even know how long lockdown will go on for. You know, in theory, it's been extended so many times that I think most of us feel it'll probably go on until the end of the year. So I really hope that next year your business, I don't know, perhaps initially can pick up more with national tourism before international tourism regime. I wanted to say thank you so much. Okay. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's nice. This has been quite cathartic. So.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you so much for inviting me and telling us about Montpos. I hope I didn't ask you too many questions.
No, and you know, I as you might have guessed, I quite like talking.
Well, good. We like hearing because we always hear you presenting, so it's nice to hear your. I think also, like, being in Montpos is such a unique situation, and I think all of us foreigners that are still here that haven't left, that some of us are even now thinking,
you want to come?
We might leave. I don't know. You know,
you want to come? I've got empty houses. You're all welcome.
Do you know what? I wouldn't know at the moment. The honest truth is, I would consider something like that, but I would feel unsafe driving all the way on my own, probably. Yeah. All these issues that we have in Colombia that people perhaps outside of Colombia don't have to think about, like safety on roads.
I guess you get to Magangay in about 6 hours from Medellin, and then but equally so, you're a white blonde woman driving alone.
Indeed
Colombia, it's true. I wanted to ask something I've forgotten off the top of my head. We're bringing this to a close, but you and I have talked about a satirical politics show for Colombia. We've got to try and think of a name.
Well, I would love to do it. I think we're both a bit, we're both a little bit scared because, I mean, you think there have been political satirists in Colombia who have been assassinated.
Well, it was recently the 21st anniversary or whatever of Jaime Garzón's murder, isn't it? Or something like that. Yeah. It was just.
This is the issue. I think that we kind of probably both you and I felt that a lot of Colombia's problems were on the way out, or that things were gradually improving. And I think this idea you have of the veil slipping, unfortunately, one feels a little bit more nervous, I think. Well, at least I feel a bit more nervous politically now than I did 12 months ago. I'm up for it. I mean, all I do is sit at home now anyway. So.
Well, I'm gonna think about it, and then we'll readdress this issue on the show at a later date.
Yes, that sounds very promising. Thank you again so much for inviting me. I feel a bit embarrassed now that
that's all right. Well, all of you out there, it's a big thank you to Emma Louise Jay for taking up the mantle of interviewer on this episode 339 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Do check out her blog at emmalouisej.com. You can find her on Twitter as well. And on YouTube, she's got her most recent rant up there now. But I think it's very coherent and very real and pertinent. I think we might sound negative, but I don't think it's negativity at this moment in time. I think it's a reality. And I think there's a big difference between that. We could just say, oh, Columbia this, Columbia that. No, but we've focused on definite issues and definite points of interest. It's not just some sort of cluster bombing of negativisms of Colombia. It's like what we are living under COVID in Colombia at the moment. So thank you to Emma Louise Jay for her time and being the guest and guest host to most have been on Columbia Calling in its history, all 339 episodes. Do check out my blog, richardmccall.com. Do look at our Patreon. Do look at other things that we put up online on Twitter and so on. And if you have anyone that you think who might like to be interviewed or to have a chat on Columbia Calling, we're still going strong. And this year has been a rich vein of form. In fact, I think COVID has brought that out in all of us. And anyway, we'll be back next week. And I believe I'm going to be talking to a .com startup guy in Medellin who's making some serious waves in, let's say, the coffee world. So tune into that one. That will be episode 340 in a week's time. Thank you again for listening. We've gone on for too long, but it's been great. Thank you to Emma Louise Jay, and bye-bye from me in Mompos and Emma Louise in El Retiro,
bye.
Antioquia.
Stay safe, everybody. Do stay safe. Bye-bye. Atarraya.